Like a lot of Americans, Steve Ammann spent the weeks after the 2016 election lying awake in a state of dread and bewilderment. The problem wasn't just the election, but the fact that nobody could explain in any sort of coherent way why America had elected, in his words, a cruel, corrupt, and incompetent man to the presidency. His book Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country, is Ammann's effort to make sense of our historical moment, to connect certain dots that go unconnected amid the deluge of hot takes and think pieces. Ammann looks to literary voices from Melville to Orwell, from Bradbury to Baldwin, to help explain the roots of our moral erosion as a people. Steve Ammann is the author of 8 books of fiction and nonfiction, including Candy Freak and Against Football. He teaches journalism at Harvard University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Steve Ammann to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
All right. So how did this particular collection come to be?
Well, the long answer is, it's a little, when they ask people, you know, in the Great Depression, you know, how'd you lose all your money?
Right.
And the general response was a little bit at a time, and then all of a sudden. That's really kind of what I've been struggling with in terms of my faith in our experiment self-governance as a country. I've been observing it and commenting on it as a journalist and more recently as a fiction writer and, you know, creative writer for 20 years, 30 years even. And, like a lot of people, the 2016 campaign and then the election and what's happened since the election has really been a stress test for kind of who we are as a country and what the story of America is going to be. And I really had a basic question. I got 3 kids, Joe. I got a 9-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 4-year-old, and they were a year younger on the night of the election. And I really, at 4 a.m. in the morning, had 2 thoughts. The first is, can I keep these kids safe, which I know sounds kind of dramatic, but if you're a parent, you think about this. And the other thing I thought was, how am I going to explain to kids who are not that sophisticated necessarily, but who are highly absorbent when it comes to basic morality, how am I going to explain this to my kids? How am I going to explain that a person who, you know, boasts about sexually assaulting women and teases disabled people and seems to take pleasure in encouraging his supporters to beat up other people, somebody who frankly wouldn't be allowed on a playground, with kids on it, how do I explain that that's the person the adult world has elected as president? I realize that sounds partisan. I apologize that it sounds partisan, but it is what I thought about. There is a basic issue of the content of somebody's character, regardless of what their policies are. And that was a real question that loomed for me. And I also thought, how did this happen? I don't want to just stick my head into the news cycle because it's like sticking your hand into a blender. It just feels chaotic and out of control. I wanted to take a step back from history. And as a storyteller and a writer, I believe stories are the basic unit of human consciousness. They're how we construct meaning. They're how we pluck meaning from the rush of experience. And so for me, I wanted to, rather than focusing on the outcomes, the Trump administration, its malfeasance or corruption or incompetence or whatever it is, to focus on the bad stories that led to Trump. It's sort of a book that was instigated by the election, but it really is about how we arrived in this moment in history. What are the stories that we told ourselves, that we consented to, that resulted in our country feeling so much meaner and crueler and more divided than I can ever remember?
Because it is a reflection, right? It reflects what has been happening over a period of time that allows that to happen.
Well, sure, but I mean, the way I would say it is, there was a time in American history, I write about this in the book, where basically you said, well, somebody's a Democrat, somebody's a Republican, you know, I'd still let my kid marry somebody from the other party. I don't think they have bad motives. I just think the policies that they're pursuing are not the best policies. That really prevailed in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and in the 80s and 90s and 2000s, it really changed fundamentally. There began to be what they call negative partisanship, which is basically thinking about politics like we think about sports. The other team is the enemy. Whatever we do to win is okay. Whatever they do to try to win is not okay. And people now think, really one of the studies I write about that's so fascinating to me. If you think about it, it's one of the sole places where unequivocally you're allowed to be a bigot in the political world. You know, you're not only allowed but encouraged to think of the other party as the enemy, as morally defective in some way or deluded. And I'm not just saying this about, you know, this is not a partisan thing. Both sides do this. When we see a bumper sticker, I can remember, I'm old enough to see a Bob Dole bumper sticker, and I thought, well, I'm not for him. He doesn't care about the same things I care about or the same people. But I didn't think Bob Dole's a bad guy and the person driving that car is a bad guy.
Right.
You know, I understood that it was a policy difference. They had different remedies for common crises that we all acknowledged. Now, if you see a Hillary Clinton bumper sticker or a Donald Trump bumper sticker, we were ready to make a whole bunch of judgments that were essentially bigotry in action, and I say that of myself as well. That means something within us, some story we tell about what it means to be an American, has really shifted in a very dramatic and dark way.
So in that dramatic shift, I guess this is the part that I still wrestle with, and you certainly look to remedy that in this book. But even as it's happening on election day, as we all sort of looked at each other, including the candidate himself, by the way, of how the hell did this happen, that we
right.
that none of us saw it coming. I mean, even if you put it into any, now people now are saying, oh, I predicted it. Most people didn't predict it, and it was
right.
You look at it and you say, all right, yeah, what happened? My question to you is, even with these shifts that you write about in the book, how come they weren't more apparent in our mind immediately as, oh, okay, now I see what was happening?
Well, that's right. I think what happened is that something that we had been heading towards arrived a lot faster. And the reason that I'm writing about bad stories, there's 17 different bad stories in this book, and they all play a role. There's a chapter about how our sort of trading in the duties of citizenship for the pleasures of fandom, being a sports fan, has contributed to this attitude that the other side is the enemy politically. There's a chapter about how people on the left tend to use political parody as a form of therapy, to kind of as an opiate, essentially, to convert what should be a real disgust and distress over our political and media dysfunction into disposable laughs. That's really part of what we've done in a larger sense. We've turned everything into entertainment. We're unable to have a serious discussion, a discourse about what we should do about immigration. And you have a candidate who's willing to go out there and demagogue and say, I'm just going to give you a short, punitive, simple solution. Build a wall. Torture the terrorists. You know, dot, dot, dot. The solutions are always incredibly appealing, because it makes what is a very complex and difficult question, how are we going to deal with the fact that we're a nation of immigrants and yet we want to secure our borders, you know, and we want people to immigrate legally? Those are really big, complicated questions, and it's much easier to really just demagogue any particular issue. It's really easy to run as a populist, and I think in general, people on the right have run as populists and they govern as plutocrats. That's been the general pattern. And that requires people, individual voters, to tell themselves a really insidious set of bad stories. One of the ones that I write about in the book is the idea that our grievances matter more than our vulnerabilities. People say all the time, why would somebody in rural America who, you know, depends on a lot of the government for their health care, for instance, Obamacare, somebody living out in Kentucky whose husband needs a liver transplant and they know that their husband is going to die if they're kicked off their health care, why would they elect somebody or cast a vote for somebody who has said, his party and he individually has said, I'm going to get rid of Obamacare. It's a death sentence for your husband. Why would somebody do that? Well, there are a couple of reasons. One is that they tell themselves that their grievances matter more than what they're vulnerable to, that it matters more that this guy's tough on crime or is going to keep immigrants out of the country. That matters more than whether they're going to have health care and the government helping them with that health care. And there's another story that we tell ourselves, which is, you know, basically, I believe that somebody is going to do what they say or they're a straight shooter because they are willing to project an attitude of always saying the first thing that comes to mind. There's no apparent artifice there. And, you know, I think a lot of people are now understanding that whatever you know, Trump said on the campaign trail he was kind of a populist, he was going to protect everybody's health insurance, it was going to be bigger and better than ever before, was in the end he was another politician, and maybe to some extent more of a salesman really than a candidate, somebody who was interested in winning, who was interested in being admired, but wasn't really interested in governing. And that's what happens when we fall victim to a kind of entertainment impulse. We end up with not a government, but a reality TV show.
One of the things that I kept on thinking about as I was reading this book is that from the very founding of this country, we always heard about checks and balances. There's a checks and balances. There's a system of checks and balances. And as you say, there's 17 stories, bad stories in this book. The fact that all of them happened at the same time, I mean, how much dovetailing is there, that the impact of that dovetailing that allowed this to happen? Because any one happening at a given time, or has happened for decades or for a generation, is one thing.
Right.
But for everything to come together in that moment is really something.
Well, it's really something if you're Vladimir Putin. You know, he made a deal. It really is. He made a deal with Donald Trump. I don't think Trump understood the terms of the deal, but Putin did. Putin said, I've got a candidate here who is perfect because he's capable of doing something that I could never do and the Soviet Union and Russia could never do, which is ushering in an era of American decline and having an American president who doesn't really believe in liberal democracy, who's constantly trying to degrade the pillars of liberal democracy, right? A free press, you know, elections that are fair, not rigged, a basic belief in government as a force for good in the lives of the people, all of that sort of pie in the sky stuff that America was really founded on, along with checks and balances and so forth. I think you're absolutely right that I write in the book about stories that predate even the founding of the country. The very idea of race is something that was fabricated. It was created to make white people feel that they had a pigmentary alliance, poor white people, with rich white people, so that they could they would go along with an agenda that was clearly not in the interests of white indentured servants or people who were in the colonies who were obviously living in poverty. Essentially said, if you're white, you're on the white side. I mean, that's a false story, but it's even more fundamental and in some ways even more wishful, Joe. The idea of all men are created equal, that's a beautiful ideal. And it was written by somebody who owned people. You know, the idea that we're a representative democracy, that one person's vote, you know, equals one person's vote, that was never true in America. It wasn't true 200 years ago when people of color, 270 years ago, when, you know, slaves couldn't vote. It wasn't true when women couldn't vote, which was the first half of our country's existence. That's not a representative democracy. And it's not true now. We still have the Electoral College. We still have people in, you know, less populous states whose votes count 3.5 times as much as somebody living in California or Texas or New York. You still have efforts, mostly on the right, to suppress voters, to discourage voters, usually low-income voters, people of color, from being able to turn out to vote. We have our elections on a Tuesday. Why in God's name are we making it more difficult to vote? Well, there is a distinct advantage. If you're a minority party whose policies are mostly unpopular, there's a big advantage to making it difficult to vote rather than easier to vote. All of these things were structural, systemic problems that were really not tested, or at least not thoroughly tested. I think in 2000, the 2000 election, which you'll recall, Al Gore won the popular vote and probably would have won the Electoral College, but, you know, it got kicked up to the Supreme Court. We knew at that point, boy, this Electoral College system is it's got a few bugs in the system. It's really slaveholder math. The reason it came into existence was to bring the southern states into the Union. Into the foundation of the United States. It was a compromise that was reached, like the Three-Fifths Compromise. So some of these stories are really age-old, and some of them are more recent. You know, people don't understand or remember. I shouldn't say they don't understand. Most people simply don't know that there was ever such a thing as the Fairness Doctrine. You know, the Fairness Doctrine arose from the concern that mass media was so powerful, the radio and TV in particular, that whoever controlled stations, whoever got a license from the government to broadcast, would have tremendous power over people. Think about if you're the founder in 1776, you know, one of the founders, they never even envisioned technology that were as powerful as radio and TV. And smart lawmakers said, hey, hold on a second. We've got to make sure that if we're going to grant public licenses to broadcasters like your radio station, that they act in the public interest. If they're going to talk about controversial issues, which they should, it should be a reasonable debate. It should include all sides of the issue. It should not be propaganda. We should not be allowing radio stations or newspapers or TV stations to be essentially propaganda, to create media silos where people can construct their own reality unimpeded by facts, for instance. So there was an effort early on to prevent fake news and to prevent propaganda. And when that was repealed back in 1987, the rise of the right-wing sort of radio world and later Fox News arose. And that was really, I think, a kind of accelerated version of what we now think of as partisan media, where all kinds of ideas and conspiracies were being peddled to people. You know, Trump was not some leader of some brand new movement. He inherited the audience share that had been out there for 25, 30, 40 years, absorbing the idea that whites were always victims, that the world was changing too quickly, that there was always some dark-skinned other who was ready to infiltrate their neighborhoods and endanger their lives, or some government bureaucrat who was going to tax them into penury or take away their guns. And, you know, that's a very powerful story. If you don't feel like you have a lot of power in the world and you do feel that the world around you is changing, you're frightened and you're looking to sort of figure out how to protect yourself. And very effective propagandists can always find somebody to blame rather than appealing to the common good and saying we're all going to have to care about each other more if we're ever going to lift each other up.
So in a rather convoluted final question, let me ask this, which is...
Well, it's a rather convoluted answer that I've been giving you, so it's, you know, fair play.
We're on the same page. 17 bad stories that you have in the book. From my reading, we really haven't learned from any of these in the sense of we're not doing anything radical to change what was in place to allow the election of 2016, which is one part of my question. The second part of my question is, with that statement, is, okay, given that, doesn't it allow and give permission to others to disregard the things that used to matter and used to be of such great concern, and to then exploit these 17 bad ideas that you have outlined in your book?
Well, what I would say is, I think you're right, that basically what you're saying is, hey, if we haven't learned, are we ever going to learn?
Right.
And the last story that I present is the bad story that moral improvement is impossible. It's not impossible. This is a country that was, you know, founded on the institution of slavery, that was overtly cruel and despicable in its conduct towards women and people of color and even the poor. And in every instance, Joe, Americans across the board, not immediately, slowly, incrementally, with lots of setbacks, have made a moral decision as a population to be better than we were, to tell a better story. You know, we fought a war to get rid of the sin of slavery, and then we had to fight more wars consistently to try to get rid of the atrocity of domestic terrorism and the Jim Crow laws. You know, we had to fight to get civil rights. Women had to fight with men to get the vote. You know, we had the Great Society. There was a war on poverty before there was a war on terror. Those things are real. The New Deal, the effort to make sure that government would take care of people in their old age, that we should have a livable wage as the wealthiest country on earth, that we should have a livable wage, that we should be able to care for our sick in this country. These aren't radical ideas. This is what any mature democracy should want to do. Teddy Roosevelt outlined all of these things back in 1910. He gave this great, beautiful speech in which he said, look, government has to try to protect the people from a kind of the interests of people who are simply want to use the system to gather wealth and power for themselves. Government has to stand in opposition to that. And he was right. And every social movement in this country, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, all of them, the movement that has brought about more tolerance and recognition of you know, people who are gay or trans, whatever it is, that kind of tolerance is something that has ultimately prevailed. But that doesn't mean it's easy. It's inconvenient. Moral progress is not impossible, but it is inconvenient. And one of the things we learned from the last election was that 103 million people, way more than voted for either of the candidates, right? Clinton gets 65 million votes. Trump gets 62 million votes again. That's one of the things we have to try to address. But beyond that, 104 million Americans didn't even bother to exercise their franchise. They were too busy. It was a Tuesday. They didn't care. It's all nonsense. Those politicians are all corrupt. What's the difference? Well, I think we have seen what the difference is. And my hope, anyway, is that not immediately and not without real activism and involvement, more people will be engaged in the next election, the 2018 election and the 2020 election. And I've been very inspired seeing these kids from Marjorie Stoneham Douglas High School in Parkland reacting to having one of their classmates come in and fire an assault weapon on them and kill a number of them. And they have said, I'm not going to be quiet about that. There is a gun lobby in this country with congressional servants who are making guns so readily available that we have mass shootings literally every week, sometimes every day in this country. And there are all these bad stories that we have consented to, that somehow sensible gun control is going to rip guns away from law-abiding Americans, or gun control isn't going to reduce mass shootings, or the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is to ban guns or make them much more difficult to acquire. And these kids in Parkland have really been crucial players in stanching these bad stories, this flow of propaganda, and in suggesting that there's a new generation of students slash potential victims who are sick of the adult world's excuses about this. They're asking common sense moral questions. Why do civilians need military-grade weapons in the first place? And that is happening. I know sometimes in the sort of blender of the news cycle, it is, if we don't step back from history, we don't always see America has also made tremendous moral progress. And we have a lot more to try to make. I mean, it goes in tides, I believe, in history. And I feel ideally what I wish for my kids, for anybody listening, for America, is that this era, the 2016 election, is a wake-up call for people that, you know, American government, this experiment in self-governance, this beautiful experiment in self-governance, is not a self-driving car. We have to be the subjects of history, not just the objects of history. And I'm cautiously hopeful that people understand that and that they are going to start to take their vulnerabilities seriously and put a little bit less focus on their grievances, their grudges against others, these feuds that kind of nourish our internal needs, but they starve our common sense.
Steve Almond is the author of the new book, Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country. It is published by Red Hen Press. Steve, thank you very much for sharing with us. It's always a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Bad Stories, published by Red Hen. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.